So my name is Brian Losgen. I'm a principal SOA architect with Microsoft. That's still a little bit hard for me to say. I've been with Microsoft for about 3 months now. I'm based in San Diego, but I've been working with Microsoft for a very, very, very long time. So I was almost an employee before. I was a six-time BizTalk Server MVP before joining Microsoft. Now I'm not an MVP anymore because I'm not independent. I'm part of the machine. So, but we're having fun. So my role with Microsoft is to help customers with SOA, with BizTalk, and anything along those lines. My passions are that, as well as the whole new wave that's coming, Oslo, Dublin, M. I've been doing a lot of work with them lately and doing some interesting stuff. So anything along those lines, that's what I like to do. And with me is Alan Smith.
Yeah, Alan Smith. I've been working for Knowit in Stockholm for the past almost 5 years now. And most of that time I've been working solidly with BizTalk Server 2004, 2006 R2, and starting to look at 2009 now. I'm also, like Brian, very keen to look at things like Dublin, M, Azure as well. I think there's going to be a big future with those technologies. A lot of exciting stuff that's coming on in the pipeline. But still focusing a lot of time on BizTalk Server, doing webcasts, doing a lot of training, and working on a lot of projects with BizTalk.
Okay, so the theme for this presentation, so I want to say something about this. I'm going to go through the chronology, how this whole presentation evolved. This is kind of a fun presentation, but it's different than the normal formal types of presentations that I do. This is a highly interactive presentation. Okay, so what that means, interactive, you know what that means, right? Okay, that means you talk too. We are going to be talking about BizTalk best practices, but I'm sure that out there, some of you guys and girls have done something that we have not done, that we have not seen, and that you've developed best practices, and you've figured out ways to do things that we may not know about. So this presentation has kind of evolved over time, and it's always worked best when it's been highly interactive. It started off when I was talking to, before I joined Microsoft, it started off probably about a year and a half ago, where I was speaking with a BizTalk technology specialist, and we started realizing, well, you know, there's this stuff that we do that all of our peers, all the other BizTalk MVPs, just know how to do these things. But then we get out in the field, and we find out what some people are doing, and it's so different. And that's because they don't know, because they haven't seen it done, because they haven't heard about it, because they didn't think about it, because they're in isolation. So that's really what gave the birth to this presentation. And it was intended not as a conference presentation at all. I've done it many times now with and without Microsoft people at various user groups throughout Southern California in different code camps, things like that. So understand that, right? This is a very casual presentation, and it's interactive. Okay? You will participate. We expect it of you, and it will be better for everybody if you participate. You know things. This is not a multicast. It's not just us talking to you. Agenda. So roughly, this will break down into three different sections. We'll start off talking about some infrastructure considerations. Just basically, how do you set up different environments? Why should you do it this way? Why should you do it that way? What's the cost benefit of doing it different ways? Breaking it down into how you do development. So even how do you set up a development environment? I've seen so many different things, some of which are just unpleasant and not happy. So we talk about that and the importance of being methodical. I mean, this goes beyond BizTalk, right? This is just normal software development best practices, being methodical about things, having structure, having naming conventions, having guidelines, following them, right? Having them is one thing, but if they just sit ignored, then it doesn't do you any good. So following. We'll talk about deployment. So I can go on and on and on, and I have. Some people in the room have seen me go on and on about deployments. BizTalk deployment does not need to be hard, and yet for a lot of people, it is. It's a scary thing. When the time comes to do that deployment, they don't sleep the night before. They get worried. It shouldn't be that way. We'll talk about some debugging techniques and testing. architectural considerations. So this is just kind of a hodgepodge of different things, right? For me, from the other BizTalk TS, just the advantages of certain architectural styles, exception management. How do you do it? How do you do it when you're crossing technology boundaries? What's a good way to do that? BAM, right? How many people in the audience use BAM on a regular basis? Okay, how many people in the audience use BizTalk on a regular basis? Nah, see, that's wrong, guys. It should have been the same hands both times. BAM is an extremely powerful tool in your toolbox. If you're not using it, you're missing out on a lot of value. It's really important. And I can go on and on and on about that, too, but I won't. And then, lastly, we'll go into some administration best practices. So you've deployed. Now what? Okay. So we're going to be, there will be a break. We'll go roughly hour and a half, something like that, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll continue on. How long this lasts is completely up to you. I mean, I've got a presentation tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, but other than that, we can keep going. Okay, so first and foremost, BizTalk is a server button. There is no play button, so that's a problem. When a .NET developer looks at BizTalk for the first time, they want to press that green arrow. Right? How come this doesn't work? Right? Why can't I step into my orchestration? Because it's a server product. Do not use XP as a development environment. I never thought I'd actually have to put that on a slide, but then I saw somebody doing it. And yes.
Should we use Vista?
No, you shouldn't do that either. You shouldn't use Windows 7 as a development environment either.
Yeah, we should just repeat the questions.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. So the question was, should we use Vista as a development environment? First off, I don't think it's even supported. I'm not sure what it says for 2009, but for 2006 R2, it's probably not a supported environment, but XP is, right? So you can actually do this, right? I went to a client site and I saw this, and they're doing it. Their main workstations that they use to do their Outlook and Visios and everything else, they've got the BizTalk development tools installed on it. And I said, you know, gee, I've heard you could do this, but I've never actually seen it.
I actually install on Vista on my laptop, install BizTalk server, because then it's faster than a virtual machine if you're doing demos in front of an audience. But I only use it for demos. I don't use it for development. And the Vista security is a bit of a nightmare as well with BizTalk.
Yeah. I mean, that's something to think about. Are you going to ultimately deploy to XP? No, you're not. Are you going to deploy to Vista? No, you're not. You're going to deploy to Windows 2008 or whatever, right? So I like to have that as my development environment. So that means virtual machines, right? And always having a virtual machine. Shared environments. This is another one, right? Especially people coming from a traditional old school, there's a dev server, a QA server, production server, right? So all the BizTalk devs point at a single dev server, and that's where they do their stuff. I've seen people having problems with that. I mean, you don't know what's going on. Messages disappear that you dropped, and the reason why is because somebody else is sucking them up, right? And you didn't know that, so you're only getting some messages and what's going on here, or someone shuts down the BizTalk service, and your app stops working, and you don't know why. So typically a shared environment is not a good place to be. What I normally recommend is that you start off in a purely virtual environment, you do everything in your virtual environment, then you have a developer integration environment or something like that. Names change with companies. But a place where all that code migrates into and different developers migrate their code into that. They're not actually doing development there, they may be doing debugging there. Right? But this is the first time the code from multiple people starts to come together in a single environment.
I was just wondering, Brian, if you'd seen, I worked on one project where they had a sort of standardized virtual machine that was already prepared. Because BizTalk can take a long time to install and you want to have everybody's machine consistent, they started off prepping a virtual machine. And there's various issues like renaming a BizTalk server can be a painful experience because of all the settings where the actual server name has been made. But I think they'd installed BizTalk server and all the components. The only thing they hadn't done was configured BizTalk server. So they could just sys-prep the virtual machine, give it a new name, then configure BizTalk server. And it's literally 5 or 10 minutes to get a new development environment set up for a new developer.
Okay. I've not seen that successfully done.
Yeah.
We've tried it. Yeah, you definitely don't. BizTalk is one of those things where you don't want to rename the machine. But if you sysprep and then you add new SID or something too so that DTC works properly, do you have to reinstall DTC after that?
I've had issues with new SID, but sysprep seems to work better.
Okay.
Yeah, the question is, can you use the same machine name? That was tried on the project. We found that some people were experiencing real latency issues connecting to SourceSafe, and we weren't sure what the problem was, something related to how the network was working. But I tended to like having, each developer has their own machine name.
Yeah, you may run into other issues. There may be DTC issues too, right, where multiple machine names, you'll get IP conflicts or something. It sounds risky. Sounds risky, and yeah, I don't know, TFS, is that going to work okay if you have multiple machines that all have the same name?
Yeah, I'm not sure. We were using SourceSafe on
that. Yeah. Okay, so the lesson learned here is virtual machines, right? And I can tell you what I'm running here, so I'm pretty lucky. So Windows 7, 64-bit, running virtual PC, 64-bit, and it's great. It's really good. Machines start up quickly. Performance is like being on a physical machine pretty well.
But the virtual machine has some problems with the performance. I'm having exactly the same configuration, and my virtual machine is very slow on virtual PC, even though it's 64.
So mine's not slow for the things that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. You may want to do normal type troubleshooting, right? Find out what services are running.
Yeah.
You may have something happening, like I've seen this where somebody's doing something like pulling the SQL adapter a lot, okay. Right?
Yeah.
And they don't know why things are slow, but they've got three of these things going on, right? So you've actually got a lot of load running on the machine. So perfmon, right?
Yeah.
Start digging into it. It should not be slow.
But are you using Hyper-V on that, or is it still virtual PC?
And so the question is, am I personally using Hyper-V, or is it still virtual PC? It is virtual PC that I'm using. So Hyper-V now, I think there's a guide coming out or something for BizTalk Server 2009. There's going to be some guidance around how to do that and how to set things up properly so it works best.
Yeah, my experience is that 64-bit makes a big difference to how fast virtual machines run. Another thing is the bottleneck is very often the actual laptop hard drive. So stick an external USB 2 drive with the actual virtual machines on there, and that seems to make a big difference.
Yeah, especially if your laptop hard drive is 5400 RPM, right? Having a 7200 RPM drive is going to make a big difference. And same with the external drives. You can get external drives that are 7200 RPM. The cheaper ones are 54, right? But if you see that they look the same, but the more expensive one is probably 7200 RPM. Fully self-contained virtual machines, so all the resources. So that's partially I do that because of lifestyle, right? I travel, I get around. So my office and my work environment is wherever. It's a hotel room, it's an airport lounge, whatever. So I need to have everything with me. I need to have everything self-contained, but sometimes I'm doing things that have to talk to external systems like SAP, and I can't really drag that around with me, not very easily. So what I've done in the past on projects is I've spoofed it, meaning I've gone to the client, sat on their network, and I've done my request to SAP, and I got the response back from SAP, and I captured that response. So then I can take that response offline, and I can continue working on the system from that point forward without needing to have access to their machine. So it's kind of a handy technique, really easy in BizTalk, right? You're just receiving a message, you just write that out to the file system, now you've got it. Now you've got that answer, and you can keep going. Project structure. So BizTalk, when you create a BizTalk project, it's going to plug in the server name, right, that you're running on. If you go into that and the properties of the project and you change it to a period, the advantage of doing that is you're helping your coworkers. If you ever have to bundle that project up, zip it up, and give it to somebody, and they hit, I've seen this, right? I've done this, where somebody gave me a project and I didn't notice that it had their machine name embedded, and I start working on the project, and I right-click deploy, and it seems to be taking a really long time, and then, oh, it deployed, okay, but that really took a long time. And the reason why was because it was going to their machine. It found their machine across the network, and it was deploying to their machine.
But that means actually that you will be using name pipes.
This machine.
But name pipes. Right. If you use localhost, would it be via TCP/IP? Which one is recommended?
I'm not sure. So the comment was, good, okay. So the comment was, if we use a dot, then we're going through named pipes, but if we use the word localhost, then it's going through TCP/IP.
Yes.
I haven't, so it should be faster if we put in the word localhost?
I think so, or at least, I mean, NamePipe is just another abstraction layer above TCP/IP, so it should be a little bit faster with TCP/IP. Not that fast that you will notice, but at least you'll get away from one abstraction layer, which is the NamePipe.
Okay. Anyone else? Comments on that?
I use local.
Just local? Okay. Yeah, I mean, you're probably flowing one message, right, to see what happens. But yeah, in a higher volume situation, that would probably matter. Okay. Using relative paths for things. So this changes, I think, with BitSock Server 2009 for the keys, right? We no longer can do dot, dot. It wants to, with a new project structure.
Yeah, it's gone over to the way that a classic C# project works. But can you still put in the relative path if you modify it?
I'm not sure.
Because you used to select the path and then modify it to a relative path. Maybe
right.
You can still do that.
Right. So if you're using R2, definitely do this. If you're using BitSock Server 2009, you may not be able to. And the advantage is that it just makes it easier if you zip up a project and give it to someone else, right? And they don't have the same folder structure as you do, right? They may have a different root folder. So this just makes it easier to share.
Yeah, make sure we check in the strong name keys into SourceSafe, because if you see a strong name key is missing and you generate your own with the same name and stick it somewhere, it's going to mess up in the deployments because everything will have different assembly references.
That's a great point. Have some kind of a common folder structure. You know, what it isn't critical, but have one, right? So typically, what I would have is something like this. So there's B projects and then something identifying the client. But if you're in an enterprise, you may not have that step, right? You may go straight into application, or you may have business unit or something like that. But have a common structure and use that everywhere. And this is, again, just general software best development practices, right? Because that way, if you come back to the project 6 months later, hand it off to somebody else, they're going to have a good idea of where to find things, and it's just more natural for them. I like to stick deployment stuff in there too. Right? So I treat everything as a single unit, so all the deployment artifacts, any supporting documentation, any special notes or anything like that travels along in that same tree. So I can just go zip it up, and here it is. This is everything.
Yeah, and test scripts and test messages can go in there as well.
Yep.
You just got to make sure to turn off the read-only attribute when you're using the test messages if they come from SourceSafe.
Mm-hmm. This is an interesting one. So how to break things down, right? So there's different ways. I mean, you've got freedom with BizTalk. You've got freedom in how you design applications. You've got freedom in how you structure projects and solutions. So that's both a good thing and a bad thing, right? It can cause grief. So generally what I like to do is the second approach here, right? And break things down by the type of artifact that I'm working with. But for simple one-off, this thing is never going to expand. It does a simple thing, and it's pretty well guaranteed to never change, right? Because you've all worked on those projects, it never change, right? So those things, it's okay if you're doing a quickie thing to just stick everything all together. Sometimes it's not worth it to set up a more complex structure. But if I'm doing something where there's a chance that that's going to happen, that it's going to grow, that this thing is going to live for a long time, then I start off with this. Even if most of those folders are going to be empty, maybe I'm not doing pipelines, but it's still there, right? The structure still supports it.
But then it might be worth to create your own project type. I mean, based on BizTalk projects, you can create your own project types that already have those folders for those attributes.
Correct.
So you get it from the very first beginning every single time you create a new BizTalk project.
So I don't know how that works. And so the comment was then you can create your own project type, so like a Visual Studio template type thing.
Yeah.
Right, and create your own project type that goes ahead and creates. Fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sure. Email me that or put it up on CodePlex.
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
I'd like to add a third variant to that one, and that is deploying things concerning like common denominators, like I have some banking thing, invoices in here and out there, so you put all your find one artifacts.
Oh, hello.
You within one one DLL, assigned to one DLL, because if you have this, if the schema changes,
right,
that's what if the map changes, you still have to redeploy everything all the time,
right,
and that means stopping long run orchestrations and so on and so forth. So
exactly. Do you want to repeat the whole?
That's a really good point, and I was going to mention.
Yeah, I was going to say something about that too. But
because I think when we come up with something like that, that's kind of a generalization that can work in some scenarios. Every scenario is different. Every project is different, and we couldn't really come out with do this and it would work in every scenario. And that was a good point. You know, what happens if you're dealing with 10 different trading partners, and you're going to be adding a trading partner maybe every month, and these trading partners are going to be modifying their systems. So if the trading partner's schema changes, then the maps to actually map that schema to your canonical schema are going to change as well. So because the orchestrations are pretty much based on the maps and the schemas, you're going to have to redeploy everything. So we did this in the Swedish Dairies project, where every Swedish dairy had its own assembly, which contained its own schemas and its own maps. And we could add trading partners, we could modify trading partners without affecting any partners or without affecting the overall system. And that was a good method that seemed to work well for us in that scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
How do you look at the best practice of using the MATLAB and the Bitstock application? How do you use the best voices or assistance?
How do you use the BizTalk application?
Yeah, like how do you mean it would take? Would it take a vanilla that being a represented system within the organization or represent a process within the organization?
I don't know if there's a single one-size-fits-all answer to that one either. So it kind of depends. But if there was something like an order process, right, in a simple situation, that might be a single BizTalk application. In a more advanced situation, a more complex order process, that might break down into separate things. So order process dot credit checks, order process dot fulfillment, things like that.
Yeah, I kind of think sometimes of these applications as being like the deployable unit and the manageable unit. So one thing that you can think of is the administrator can see a list of applications and they can start and stop these applications. They can deploy them. They can sort of redeploy or update at the application level.
That's one of the things that we often see that for maintainability and manageability, as you would stop an application or
that would be
difficult if you look at the application as a process.
Mm. There are sometimes schemas that are shared across applications, and if you keep them in one application and deploy multiple
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, an application can be a container for schemas, and then it doesn't actually do anything. You just reference it from other applications. When we were talking about EDI in the previous meeting, we were saying, have your own BizTalk application to deploy all your EDI schemas to. So you can just reference that from another application.
So that one gets a little bit messy then if you want to rev that core thing, and you've got six other applications that are referencing it, because the admin tool will not let you remove that, right, while those other things are there and running, and if some of those are long running. So it gets complicated. Putting the version inside the namespace can help a lot, right, and is a good strategy, even outside, like in WCF also, right, because that way you've got it at the BizTalk level, it's the root node name plus the root node namespace. Right, so if you've got the version number embedded in that root node namespace, then you can do a partial MSI that has it. So you've got this additive thing that's being added in. I don't think the admin tool will choke on that.
Yeah, I think one thing that's worth mentioning here is spending a lot of time getting this right at the beginning of a project. Because when you go into Visual Studio and you do like file new project, add a new schema, you're actually committing to the structure that your project is going to take. And it can be a sort of a long and painful experience if you've got to refactor a BizTalk project. I've had something where doing a simple change that I thought would go very quickly ended up taking about 2 or 3 hours with all the other stuff that it touched and affected, all the binding files and all types of stuff. So one thing that I do is just draw a dependency diagram on a piece of paper or on a whiteboard and just sketch out what is dependent on what happens if I change this, what is it going to affect, and that can help you to sort of minimize all of the cross dependencies that you've got.
Yeah. And think about it before you file a new project, right? Think it through first, then start. Anything else on this? Naming conventions. Yeah, have one. I mean, it really doesn't matter when you're in your own little isolated virtual machine, right? It really doesn't matter. But once you start deploying, then you go into a shared environment. And now everyone's stuff is coming together. And I've seen real horror stories where, you know, different developers have, they've got naming conventions. Yeah, every developer has their own. And the end result of that is kind of a maintenance nightmare for the poor person that's got to do the administration of the system. And it happens, right? So this is such a simple thing to avoid, to have a good naming convention. Someone did a post. There are some conventions out there that are available that you can use as a starting point. How you do it doesn't really matter as much as doing it, right? Having a convention, sticking to it. It's also a whole lot easier when you're moving people between projects, or even when you come back to that same project after a year, right? If you followed some consistent patterns, it'll be a whole lot easier for you to just jump right back in and get to do what you need to do.
Yeah, you've also got to think about things like things that are internal to BizTalk server, like maybe the target namespace of schemas, stuff that's just going to live inside the message box is never going to be seen externally. But you've got to think about it a lot more when it comes to the target namespaces on schemas that you're exposing as a web service, especially if you're going to be doing versioning. You really need to think about how those are going to be named.
Mm-hmm. What, no comments? You all have naming conventions, right? Okay, I see some nods. How many people have a naming convention that they consistently follow and that they're happy with? Excellent. Good. You guys are good. Okay, so we'll move on. So then you probably also know that it's painful, to, as Alan said, to rename certain things, right, and should be avoided. And newbies, I love this, right, when they rename something and they don't realize that the project name it became part of the namespace for their schema, and then they can't figure out why things aren't working. But you have to be... We said this already.
Yeah, the common one is rename an orchestration file and don't rename the .NET type. And you've actually got to change it in both places for the changes to take effect.
Yeah, and there's also things that can happen. So funny story here. During the BizTalk 2004, very, very early on, I had like a pre-alpha of the first attempt at a lab, right? And trying to teach this to a class of people, right, when the BizTalk beta had just come out, right? And what happened was one of my students, I think the project name they were supposed to use was something like EDI schema, right? Something like that. And what they did was EDI space schema. So that's not valid, right, in a namespace. So what happened behind the scenes was that EDI got used as a target namespace, and then the rest of the lab didn't work. And if you're looking at this in Solution Explorer, it looked okay because you couldn't really see the extra space. So it was kind of interesting. But that's one example of how deeply this stuff can go.
Yeah, a good thing I teach people is if you go in the BizTalk administrator console when you've got everything deployed, you can go into all the schemas and just see the target namespaces and nodes for all the schemas, and you can just check very quickly the whole project what those names are in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's one I could go on for a while about. Deployment does not have to be a difficult thing. It really doesn't. How many people think they have a good BizTalk deployment project process, and when they've got a new version, they can just blast it through and go out for lunch? How many people think they can do that now? A couple of little hands. Okay, most of you didn't put up your hands. So I was at a Microsoft client earlier today, and I'll tell the same story that I told there. Prior to joining Microsoft, I was a consultant, and I was working at a financial services company in San Diego, and they had me for 2 months. I was there for 2 months, which is great because I got to stay away from airplanes for 2 months. And I had finished off part of what I was supposed to be doing a little bit early, and they said, well, can you go take a look at our deployment? It's kind of, we're not sure if we're doing it the right way. So I went and I looked at what they were doing, and I said, okay, I'm going to go away. And I started writing some scripts. and very tedious, right? This is not intellectually stimulating stuff. This is not the sort of thing I enjoy doing, right? It's, you know, do a command line thing and watch it go three steps and fail, and then you fix that. Watch it go four steps and fail, you fix that. Watch it go five steps, right? And as you're going through these iterations, they get progressively longer and longer and longer, and you drink a lot of coffee, right, just trying to stay awake. But then after 2 days of doing that, I went to their IT pro, and I said, okay, I think we're ready. Let's try deploying this now to your QA environment. And it took us about 6 minutes, roughly, and we deployed three medium complexity BizTalk applications, including starting the orchestrations and everything. And he looked at me, this is great, I'll never forget this, he looked at me and he said, you know, is that it? I said, yeah. I said, well, last time it took 2 days, and we're not sure if we did it right. I said, well, I just spent 2 days, but you know what? Nobody will ever spend those 2 days again. You can script everything. You have the tools. Does it take some time to set this up front? Yeah, you bet. Is it exciting stuff? No, not at all. It's mind-numbingly dull, boring, at least to me. Maybe if you're, you know, feeling kind of bored and sleepy, it would be a good task to do when you're not feeling really bright and energetic. But it's really worth investing the time into doing it.
I think Scott Kolstock finds it really interesting. He's done the deployment framework and put in a lot of work for that. And that was originally in BizTalk 2004. Microsoft were recommending using MSIs for BizTalk deployments. It was a really painful experience in 2004. So Scott came out with the deployment framework that was using, was it Ant or something like that? Ant deployed BizTalk.
Yeah.
And he's been evolving that as well. So that's kind of parallel now with the 2006 stuff. Some people still choose to use a deployment framework. But I do tend to do a lot of scripts with BTS Task as well. We've got a guy at our company who's doing some good stuff with PowerShell and using that instead of the batch scripts and getting some good results with that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So it's a really, really good thing to do. If you go to my blog, which is blog.brianlosgan.com, there's a link coming up here. I have an early version of some of the scripts I have up there, and I keep telling people I have a draft update that's been in draft state for about a year. And eventually will not be in draft state anymore. If I keep telling people, I'll kind of embarrass myself into having to finish it and get it posted. But it's kind of a starting point, right? So it goes through a lot of the different things. And you can bundle up a lot inside of those MSIs. You can bundle up everything. You can put rules in there if you like, and there's some caveats around doing that. You can put your binding files in there. Do I talk here about that? No, I think it's on the next slide. No, I do. Okay, so the creation of the MSIs, right? So what we're talking about here, to be clear, is how the MSI gets created, right? And what I like to do is I start off in this virtual development environment, right, that's fully self-contained, my VM. And inside that, the way it migrates from there to the developer integration environment is I do the scripts. So the scripts are done very, very early on in the process. By the time I migrate to that first shared environment, I'm using the scripts. If it fails, I go back to the development environment, fix it, do it again. That way, when you get to the development integration environment, when the time comes to go to the next environment downstream, you've got your scripts. They've already been tested. You saw them work once. They should work again. Right? So that's just stylistically, that's how I do it. Now, I also script the creation of the MSIs, and the reason why I do that is, again, responding to an experience I had, where I had, you can right-click export MSI, right, from the BizTalk admin tool. Easy. But what happened to me was I did that once, and then I took the MSI and I went to the target machine, I installed it, and it started nattering about some ports that I knew I had removed a long time ago. And where are these ghosts coming from? And what happened was there was an old binding file that was added as a resource in the development environment that I'd forgotten about that shouldn't have been there anymore. And that was traveling along with the MSI. So what I do is in my scripts is I scrape it clean, basically. So first I export the current bindings in the development environment so that I've got a snapshot of what it was like before the batch file ran. Then I remove the BizTalk application. Then I deploy it completely from scratch. Right, then I create the MSI off of that. Binding files, I typically have one for every environment, and those get added in as resources. So the creation of the MSI is click, click, right? And you're done. An MSI falls out the other end.
That's one question. I don't know if you've come across this, but we've certainly come across this in projects. The thing is, you build all these scripts, you've got all your binding files that are ready to configure all your ports. You deploy to BizTalk server, and then somebody makes some change in the administration console, modifies maybe a retry interval or a port address. Right. And the next time you deploy, that old binding script is going to go in and wipe out everything. So do you have any guidelines for how to...
Yeah, fire them. I mean, that's a process thing, right? Mm. So if they find that there is a need to make that kind of a change, right, for that particular environment, then it should be communicated all the way back, right?
Yeah.
Because it should be made in the binding file at the development machine where the MSI is going to be generated from next time. And that should also go into source control, right? So if it's just something that happens at runtime and it never gets communicated back and it never goes into source control, then, yeah, you're going to have that problem again. And someone's going to spend time, again, trying to figure out what the problem is. Be kind to your infrastructure, folks. They'll be happier with you. So if you can save them some time, if you can put in, have a separate binding file. So I normally, as a convention, I'll have my namespace, project name, underscore prod, underscore QA, underscore dev, right? Something like that, and separate binding files for each environment. And then I'll put in as much information as I can. So depending on the client, sometimes even in QA, they don't want to put in passwords or something like that. So that's fine. Then it stays blank, and then when they import the application, they're going to have to put that in. But sometimes it's okay to do it. And sometimes it's okay to have it there for the dev machine, so you can do it that way. Never, ever for prod, of course. Right? You would never do that because it's in clear text. And that just makes it easier for them. Yeah, never deploy from Visual Studio, please. Anyone? Any? No? Okay. I've seen it done. So with BizTalk 2004, sometimes it was more common to find Visual Studio installed on a production server because there was some tooling there. Now there's no need, no excuse. It shouldn't be there, period. Remember that you do have other resources that can travel along with the MSI, right? You can stick virtual routes in there. So this gets a little bit interesting because the virtual routes got to exist on your build machine, right? So normally I've got a script for that too, right? That kind of bootstraps the whole process and will create the virtual route on the build machine, then add it as a resource to the MSI so it'll travel along with it. Helper classes, right, can go along with it, anything that needs to be GACked. Support DLL. So this one, I had an interesting one with this where I did a project that used the SAP, the older SAP adapter. I don't know if this still holds true with the new one. But the older one, the way it used to work was a DLL was created that had to go into a specific SAP My Business folder. There was a spot, right? And this is mandated by SAP. This is not a Microsoft or a BizTalk thing. This is SAP. But it had to be in a specific spot. And the client that I was working at, they had on their dev and QA servers, that was C:\Program Files SAP something or other. But on the production server, it was on D drive, right? So we had to kind of figure out how to do this. So BizTalk has post-processing scripts, and they had an environment variable. It told me where I was. So what I did was I did a post-processing script that detected the environment it was in, and it moved that DLL to the appropriate folder. The person doing the install had no idea, right? They didn't know this was going on. This is just something that happened. But this is an example of one more thing that you can automate that isn't a bullet on a checklist that they may miss. And if you missed that one, this application would not work, right? That DLL had to be in that location or the entire app wouldn't function. Yes?
How do you deploy a business rule?
So you can add business rules as a resource. There's a way to do it with BTS task, but the problem becomes if you want to version the assembly and someone's changed the rules using the rules composer, right? Because the whole idea behind the rules engine is decouple the rules, which change a lot, from the process, which doesn't change a lot. So the idea is that you might be making some runtime changes. If the business rules are embedded resource in the MSI, then they're going to deploy and they're going to overwrite what was there before, right? So if they've changed it, you're going to wipe that out. So that's it's a caveat, right? So there are times when it's okay to do that, but if it's something in a very dynamic environment where it's likely that changes are happening, then I wouldn't do it that way.
And people may often have the business rules being modified on the test servers, going through various tests before you actually take the rules out to production. So you could just use the export and import of the XML for that.
That can be done through the
So the exporting, I think you can probably do it through the API. You may have to do something with WMI, I'm not sure. But yeah, if there's a way. So I would try to script it.
Yeah, I think Scott, there was an issue with that. I think Scott Colstock solved it in his deployment script, deployment framework, but I'm not sure exactly what that is. It's a while since I've looked at that.
Okay. And then the post-processing scripts, yeah, you've got them. Use them. So the initial ESB guidance, we spent a lot of time on scripts because it was a very complicated thing and it touched a lot of different pieces. So we spent days. I spent 2 days, two very long days, working on scripts to get us started. And then I threw it over the wall to Tom Cantor. Anyone know Tom Cantor, the name? He's around, quite visible. But he's a scripting god, right? He dreams in script. Right? And he spent two very, very long days on it. And then he threw it over the wall to Marty Wozniacki, who spent two very long days. And 2 days of Marty's time is like 3 years for mere mortals. And then in the end, we had some post-processing scripts for BizTalk that would do things like create Windows accounts, create app pools, create service accounts, set identities of app pools, everything, right? All handled through script. You didn't know it. You just went click, click, and you'd run the MSI. But behind the scenes, all these things would be working and doing stuff for you. So you can get to that point. It's a lot of work if you're doing something that sophisticated. But a lot of the things that we were doing there fall into the category of initial deployment only, right? Like the creation of service accounts, things like that. So in a case like that, you may want to break that out into a separate script that's not run as part of the MSI, because when you go and you rev, you create a new version of the application, you're probably not going to need to create the groups because they're going to exist and so forth. Yes? BAM deployment?
Yeah.
BAM deployment should be scripted. Oh man, the last one I did, the last one I spent a long, well, it wasn't actually that bad. But BAM deployment, it tends to be an iterative process. So first you go in and you define your tracking model and then you generate the infrastructure, which I of course have scripted. And then what happens is you get to the end and you go to create some reports off of the data that you've captured and you say, oh, I forgot the blah, right? So you go to the beginning, you change the model, now you have to redeploy. So I script that, all of that. What I did on the last project, and this is part of the thing with BAM, I probably should do a blog post or something about this, but I have this technique that I use. Actually, there is an early blog post I did about 4 years ago where I was hammering against the MapPoint web service. And it was a big presentation the next day. This is Callaway Golf, presentation to the C-level people of all the wonderful work we had been doing and what they've been spending their money on, right? We were going to show them. We were going to show them some really pretty graphs. And what happened was that day I found out that there was a limit to how many times in a 24-hour period you could call the MapPoint web service. I was in trouble, right? I mean, it was late, this thing was first thing in the morning, and all of a sudden I've lost my ability to generate metrics. What do I do, right? So I did a blog post. The way I came up with solving that is that I wound up, actually, when you deploy BAM, it's going to do some things like create a stored procedure. When you call the BM command line tool, it creates some infrastructure for you, including a stored procedure. And that stored procedure is what gets called when there's data to capture. So what I did was I just started working with that stored procedure directly and stuffing data into it. So that got me past my immediate panic situation. But then I moved that forward because the really cool thing is if you're doing BAM stuff, it's really important that people can visualize what you can do with it. right? That's the whole point. You want to show them a dashboardy type experience, red light, green light. You want to show them a trend line. In the past year, this is what performance has been like. This is how many orders we've processed, or this is how long intervention has taken. You want to show them that kind of stuff. But if you are in development mode and you just deploy all the infrastructure and then you click go and generate 5,000 messages, all your activity is going to happen in a 2-minute period. That's a boring graph, right? You can't get a trend line over time. So what I do now is I went a little bit overboard on this. Maybe even for me, I went a little bit too far. But I call into the stored procedure and I stuff in data that gives me the ability to control time. So I have control over the time when that happened, the chronology of it. And what I've done is I've actually set it up. So I started doing that in script, right, where I'm just calling in SQL, right? I'm just calling the sort procedure repeatedly, going in, changing parameter values. But that got a little bit too complicated because when I changed the model, then I'd have to go in, I'd have to touch all of those things. And if I wanted meaningful graphs, I'd need 30 or 40 of those insert statement or calling the stored proc. Right, so it just got a little bit sloppy. So I went to the next level. And what I did was I keep that information out in an Excel spreadsheet. And I have an SSIS package that takes that, moves it into a temporary table inside of SQL Server. And then from there, I call the iteratively. I go through and I call the BAM stored procedure to insert the data over and over and get that data into it that way. So what I did on the last project, talking about scripting, is I had the script. It was so close to perfect where I could go click, click, deploy, and what it would do is it would scrape everything clean for me. It would undeploy everything else, right? All the other tracking stuff associated with that particular thing would get removed. It would look at my spreadsheet, it would import it in, it would stuff it into the database, it would flow over into there, it would have deployed the BAM infrastructure again, right? So the stored proc would have been created again, the cubes would have been created again, the real-time analysis tables would have been created again, then it populated it with all the data, and then I was good to go, right? And then I could have my reports, and here, 12 months of activity, and it's not all smoke and mirrors. I was actually using the infrastructure. I was using the BAM infrastructure, but I was smoke and mirrors at the very beginning about what created the data. But the flow through the system was real BAM stuff. Why I say it was almost perfect was SSIS was popping up a dialog box where you had to press OK, and I couldn't make it stop. Right? Everything else was just fully... You know, it'd be great because sometimes these things can be time-consuming. When you deploy a BAM infrastructure, if you've got a fine-grained time resolution, it's going to go through and pre-populate those time dimensions for you. So if you've got down to the second levels of granularity, that can take some time. It can take like 5 minutes. So what I wanted was click, click, and then I'll go for coffee, and I'll read the paper, and then I'll come back, and it'll be finished. But I couldn't do that. I had to be there to click OK. That's my next mission, though. I'm not giving up. There must be a way.
Well, when you redeploy the BAM things, wouldn't it clear off all the primary import?
Okay, so I'm talking purely in development mode, right?
Okay, but my question was like this deployment, whatever methodology you have, it must be repeatable
right.
On all the environments. So you can't have like one script for dev environment and another for the prod environment.
No, well, this would be just in pure development mode when you're in iterative development. This is not related to deployment, right? This is when you're creating the tracking infrastructure in the first place, and when you're creating the reports, probably, or somebody else is going to create the reports, you're going to generate the data, right? Maybe you report against those cubes, or maybe you hand somebody the cubes, right? So that part of it is what I'm talking about. That was my long-winded answer. To deploy, actually, for real, then, yeah, you can make that part of the script, too, where you can use the update commands to deploy. And that will modify that will modify it without having to scrape clean. But in dev, you don't want to do that. You want to scrape clean and start over. Especially if, because the tedious part of this is, and it's silly, you know, you're highly skilled developers, architects, and fiddling with dates in a spreadsheet just so the graph coming out the other end will look better, right? but it's really important. So, I mean, this comes down to the importance of BAM. It is really, really important, and it just adds so much value. Oh, that was a long sidetrack. So the bottom line on this one is it shouldn't be frightening. You shouldn't, oh God, I can't do anything Monday night because Tuesday we have a deployment. God, I hope it works. It shouldn't be like that, right? It should be highly repeatable. You should have a high degree of confidence. And if you put the time in up front to set something up properly, then you'll have that.
Yeah, you get rewarded more than 10 times, probably 100 times over for any investment you do in the scripts.
Yeah. I mean, there's a cost up front to doing it, but the ultimate savings are huge, right? And the amount of time it might save you in troubleshooting, oh, yeah, that DLL didn't get moved across, or, oh, I forgot to create that virtual route, right? The amount of time it can save you is huge. So it's well worth. And I know sometimes it's hard to explain that to a manager, that you want to spend 2 days, 3 days, 5 days writing scripts, right? Shouldn't you be writing code? You're a developer. But
the worst one is spending 3 days writing a Word document that tells somebody else how to install it.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, the end of the day, either you can hand off something where somebody goes click, click, or you can hand off, here's 23 easy steps, right? Follow these, and everything will work great. Debug view. Everybody knows debug view, right? Show of hands. Who doesn't know what debug view is? Okay, great. Excellent. Good. Okay, wonderful tool. Best practices analyzer. You guys seen this? Anyone not know what it is? Okay. So basically, you can point this. It's a rules-driven thing. I don't mean BizTalk rules, but it has some rules, and you point it at a BizTalk environment, and it'll go through, and it's a read-only operation, so it's completely non-volatile and safe to do. And what it's going to do is it's going to compare what it finds with a set of rules of what it knows should be good practices. And those rules, it changed dramatically. I think the first one had like 41 rules or something like that, and then went to 200 rules. And those rules come from people out in the field, from MVPs, from BizTalk Rangers. This is the right way to set things up, and it'll go through, and it won't change anything for you, but it'll give you a nice report that could potentially highlight problem areas that you've got.
So that's more on test and production environments, isn't it, rather than dev environments?
Yeah, but sometimes, if you've got a really slow dev environment, you may want to use it and check it out as part of the tuning process. The BizTalk admin tool, it's more than just a pretty tree view, right? Especially now, even more so with 2009. That's a powerful little tool. That new query tab that you have, there's some cool stuff that you can do in there. So if you haven't ever really paid attention to it and all you ever do is start and stop applications or import bindings, take a little bit of time. You can take a look at the subscription viewing capabilities. You can see the activation subscriptions. There have been times where that has been an extremely powerful diagnostics tool for me, where I've gone in and, oh yeah, no wonder it's not working, look at the subscription. Right? So it's a great portal into the infrastructure, into the BizTalk management database. Learn it, use it. A lot of people just do the simple thing and look past or don't know that the other gems are in there. There's an orchestration debugger. How many people use the orchestration debugger? Okay. That's good. You guys are good.
Do you find anybody actually sticks breakpoints in and steps through orchestrations, or do they just use it to replay stuff that's happened?
I just use it to kind of find out what's going on if I'm baffled.
Yeah.
Right. If everything else has failed and I'm still baffled, then I'll do that. Setting the breakpoints, I generally haven't because I just haven't, as a general rule of thumb.
Yeah, that's what I found from most people's experience, that they don't really use it in the traditional debugger that we think of.
Right. Now, if it were faster, and if it simulated an orchestration, and it was more like the .NET experience, right, then I think more people would use it. But if you think about what's going on under the hood, right? I mean, this is still a server-based product. There's chatter back and forth to SQL Server, right? So there's a lot of things going on. So it's not like you're just an IL going line by line by line. There's a lot more going on. Sorry.
Isn't there a risk of leaving breakpoints? If you're setting breakpoints and forget to remove them?
Yeah, I don't know. When you build in release mode, I don't know if those orchestration breakpoints travel. I guess they might, because they're
I don't think it affects the DLL, does it? You must store it in the database.
It's got to be in the database, yeah. Yeah, it's got to be in the management database. There's a homework assignment. Go hacking around the management database and see where the breakpoints are kept. Yes?
Is there an easy way to debug your help purpose class from your orchestration?
Yeah, so the question was, is there an easy way to debug a helper class? The easiest way is to call your helper class from a WinForms app and step through it. But, yeah, so if you can't do that, then what you can do is you can have Visual Studio in debug mode and attach to the BizTalk service, so BTS, NTS, VC, attach to that, and your breakpoint will get hit, and you can step through it. So commonly for pipeline components, you might do that just to see what's going on inside a pipeline component. That's a powerful technique. I've used that a lot. So if you weren't aware of that, then coming here this evening has just been worthwhile for you. That makes it all worthwhile. Ooh. Did you talk about testing?
Yeah. With testing, sort of the one thing that you start off when you're writing code and you start working with NUnit is you get into the habit of doing unit testing. And unit testing is really challenging in BizTalk Server because you can't really test an orchestration in isolation or a receive port or a pipeline and so on. So we tend to think about it as being a functional testing stage, but we tend to sort of try and do sort of minimal, sort of the shortest test we can do rather than testing the whole system, try and do small tests. BizUnit is a fantastic tool, and the BizUnit extensions. I kind of had a bit of a love-hate relationship with BizUnit to start off with. I liked what it did, but I didn't like the fact that you had to use XML configurations for everything. And now that's been changed in the latest version. You can actually use C# for actually driving all the tests. So I do like working with BizUnit. BizUnit is basically a set of extensions that you've got that you can drive from a testing engine. So NUnit is a great testing engine, and also Visual Studio Team System are the testing tools that you've got in that. Basically, I think VSTS, the testing tools, took all of the actual same functionality as NUnit. They just use different attribute names. Any sort of if you know how to use NUnit, you already know how to use VSTS. I find NUnit can be a bit nicer for BizTalk solutions because you don't need to have it in Visual Studio, but it's just your preference which one you want to go for there.
So it gives you the ability to have a message come in somewhere through a file drop. Something happens in a database, and you can check the database and see if the right thing happened in the database. Things like that, that you can do in an automated fashion. Press a button, red lights, green lights, green lights.
Yeah, so it can be a bit tedious writing the code, especially if you're going to do all the validation and checking everything, because you're typically having to generate an XML message. You think about generating messages and then actually verifying that, you know, sort of 50 rows have been inserted in the SQL table and they've all got the right values as well. Things that can be really difficult to track is like, you know, if you've built flat file schemas and you haven't changed the code page, if any one of the three Swedish vowels come through, that will get sort of eliminated from the target document. So that's stuff that can slip through that can be really challenging to test for.
And, of course, testing is one of the first things to fall away when deadlines loom, right? So the biggest problem around testing is a management issue.
Yeah, so next to the button where you deploy the BizTalk application, it's good to have another button which will test the BizTalk application as well and have the developers get into a habit of using those tests a lot. And I find that, again, it's an investment in time that will save you time in the long run. If you've got, you know, some, I normally have NUnit running, and if I just click on the button or whatever and it copies my files across and I see all my orchestrations running, it's less time than, you know, me having to go in and manually copy those files in Windows Explorer.
Mm-hmm. So it's another one of those things, right, where it costs up front. There's an investment you have to make up front, but it pays off long term. And I guess we keep going. Wow. Small font. Loose coupling. BizTalk is a pub sub engine. You all know that, right? if you don't know that, what are you doing at a BizTalk user group meeting? So use it. Use it for that. So I did a post about 3.5 years ago on creating a state machine pattern using BizTalk. I mean, this stuff works so well to have everything loosely coupled and direct bound through the message box. Is there a cost? Is there a performance cost? Yes, there is. Is it worth it? I think, yeah, it is. You may need to scale a little bit more on the hardware side, potentially, to handle it, but it's well worth it. From an architectural design standpoint, it gives you much greater flexibility. From an agility standpoint, the ability to add new functionality to an existing app, potentially without changing the running existing app, which is already deployed, I mean, that's huge, right? So that's really, really important. And if you look at the ESB guidance, I mean, that's how it works, right? It formalizes the process of having this metadata envelope that has some information inside it related to the processing of the message. But that's, I mean, it's just an envelope, right? And the way the services work inside the ESB guidance, a lot of them the itinerary services, is they will pick up on those special promoted properties inside this envelope and will process the messages based on that. So really, I mean, this is the way to go. I mean, this is, I always say use direct bound ports wherever possible. It's just a cleaner way to implement things. Plus, if you've got, I mean, there's not very many applications around. So if you had a scenario where you implemented something like an order processing system and you deploy it to production, and then you get a change, right? Now there's a policy change, and everything that you send out for a credit check, you have to archive that into an audit place somewhere. Had you done this all kind of embedded as a monolithic application, then you've got a code change, right? You've got to go back into your application. It's a design effort. It's a development effort. There's code migration that has to happen, so sometimes that means long, time-consuming change control processes. There's regression testing that has to happen, yada, 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 right? It's not, even though all you want to do is just capture a message that's flowing through the system. So what you could do instead, if you were all completely loosely coupled through the message boxes, you could just be listening in for, you create a new send port, listening in for that type of message, or an orchestration listening for that type of message, and you do something with it, without touching the running application, right? It's very powerful, very powerful. .NET developers can't do things like that. We can. So it decouples the processes completely. One of the tenets of service-oriented architecture, right, is decoupled. It pushes you in this direction. Once you start doing it that way, it's kind of like WCF starts making you think in contract first. So does this. It kind of promotes a service-oriented mindset. And the orchestrations that you create, really, those are like enrichment orchestrations or a sub-process. Or, you know what, this credit check thing? It's an orchestration, yeah, but it's a service, right? Let's call it that. It's a service. It's a credit check service that happens to be implemented as an orchestration, and it's loosely coupled through the message box. Okay, so filtering options. what do I mean by this? Those choices are not bound by message type. Yeah, so I have some special context properties, but now I'm completely in the ESB guidance world now. I mean, and that is based on context properties. So you're doing your selections of messages and deciding what to process based on context properties. Newbies to BizTalk don't realize this. They don't want to use direct bound. They want to directly go into the admin tool and say, I want to bind this logical orchestration port to that send port that I've just created. But guess what? Under the covers, you're still doing this, right? So why not do it from the start? Because this is the way the BizTalk engine works. If you do it this way, if you architect your applications like this, as a set of granular services that are working loosely coupled, as opposed to a large monolithic run-my-business orchestration that nobody can work on or understand, then you'll be a lot more agile, and it'll be a lot more resilient, and you'll be a happier developer.
Just watch out for those looping subscriptions.
Yeah. Yeah, looping subscriptions is one problem. I've also had a problem, too, with BAM. If you've got something that's reentrant, right? So if you've got something where a process runs and then something's wrong, right? You received an order, you're going through it, no, I checked with SAP, customer's on credit hold. So I'm going to send this off to a SharePoint portal, and a human being's going to come to that SharePoint portal. They're going to fix it. They're going to resubmit. I'm going to pick it up again and run it through again. But the problem is, if you're using BAM, that you can get a duplicate entry. So you'll get a primary key violation doing that because that orchestration already ran, right? So now it's running again. So you need to just kind of think that through a little bit. It's not that difficult. So you can have your own activity IDs and things like that to get around that. This might be a good point to talk about SharePoint. I mean, this, to me, SharePoint is a great tool to involve humans in a process. I mean, it really is. And it's so easy for us to talk to SharePoint from InBizTalk. And everyone, I don't know how it is here in Sweden, but SharePoint's everywhere in the U.S. It's like a virus, right? There's a SharePoint, right? They're everywhere. You can't avoid SharePoint. It's a smash hit. It's already deployed. Broadly, there's people that know how to use it. Odds are, if you're developing an enterprise solution for somebody, odds are somewhere in that business unit, they've got a SharePoint site. Right? So what I really like to do is I like to do a process site for people, meaning they've got something like an order process. I want the order management team to have a portal that they can go to where they're able to look at this thing and they can get some interesting metrics about their process, which might be coming from BAM, probably is coming from BAM. If there's some orders that need human intervention, there's a list, right? Click on the edit button and it opens up inside of an InfoPath form using form server or the client InfoPath. Let them edit it there and then write it back. So I did another blog post probably about 2 years ago where it was an order process. And this thing was, I really wanted to make this work. And the way it was working was what I described in SharePoint, the older SharePoint, using InfoPath. And I had this code behind the submit button, right? That was like, it was growing and growing, and I had this really complicated stuff happening. Because when they went in and they modified the order to correct it, like, oh, they ordered the wrong part number, I'll fix the part number, right? The order management people would fix the part number, and they would hit resubmit on the order. And what would happen is the resubmit, when they pressed that, it would call a web service that I had exposed inside BizTalk and resubmit the message in, and the code started getting really gnarly and complicated, and then there was security boundary issues, and, well, what if the web service isn't running? What am I going to do then when they hit submit? So the blog post that I did was, it was kind of a aha moment, right, where BizTalk can query SharePoint views. So what I did was there was a single SharePoint document list where these orders went, and there was a metadata column that I had created, which you can set in the SharePoint adapter. When you write out to a SharePoint list, you can set a metadata column value, and the status that I wrote out was to be fixed or to be repaired, something like that, and it would go in there. The person using the portal, they would click on a link for show me the list of orders that need to be repaired, and they would get that view. And they would see a list of all the things they needed to repair. When they repaired it and when they hit submit, instead of doing all the complicated, you know, lines and lines of code and calling all that stuff, and maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work, and gee, I hope it's up. Instead of all that, I just saved it back to the SharePoint list with a new state. Then I had another BizTalk receive location monitoring that same document list, but calling the view. Calling a view that said, show me all of the ones that have been resubmitted only. So what have we done here? Doing it this way, we've decoupled the BizTalk and the SharePoint thing completely. So if BizTalk is down for whatever reason, the SharePoint order management team, they've got their list of things that need to be fixed. They can go through, they can make their fixes, they can save. And when BizTalk comes back, it's going to pick up all that stuff. So we've decoupled that. We've made them asynchronous processes. We've eliminated the amount of code I had went from that to that, right? I mean, it's just so easy, and it's so clean, and this is how I think we should work with SharePoint and people. I'm preaching again, aren't I? How many people here have done that? A few. Okay, good. Hopefully, if someone asks that same question later, it'll be more.
Yeah, we've been finding the InfoPath is a bit of a stumbling block there.
So I haven't worked with the new, the InfoPath form server. Mm. I'm about to next week, probably. But yeah, InfoPath, my experience goes back to 2003, with InfoPath 2003, and it really didn't like it when schemas changed. And if you're in development mode, that's kind of a problem, because schemas are in a state of flux. Also, using InfoPath, the client tool, there's licensing, right? I guess I'm with Microsoft, I shouldn't. You have to have client licenses for everyone, right? But using InfoPath Form Server, it's server-based, and you don't need client licenses. So that may or may not be a concern. Is that the problems you had, the schema?
It was the licensing thing. We went in and we did a proof of concept and showed them how wonderful everything was, and then we told them that they had to buy InfoPath for every user, and right. They wanted an ASP.NET site after that.
Right.
Yeah, we didn't have the option to use the form server then. So, but that would be what we'd probably go for now.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think it's pretty well full fidelity from what I understand. So if you've done something in InfoPath, you can render it either way, I believe. So it's up to you. You have two choices. So that's a powerful, powerful tool. And it saves you a lot of time, too. Exception management. Yeah, so this is fun because BizTalk solutions aren't just BizTalk solutions. They're BizTalk plus MQ series plus IIS plus SQL Server over here, plus you've got Trading Partner, right? You're all over the place. You're jumping between different technologies, and that's what makes it a little bit challenging to be a BizTalk developer sometimes, because you have to span all these different technologies. And then guess what? You may have different ways of advertising the fact that an exception has happened and different ways of handling them in each of those technologies. What if you're calling a JMS thing and there's a Java piece of your application somewhere? That's part of your process, right? But what happens if that throws an exception? How are you going to track that? What happens? How do they find it? Right? These are tough, tough questions. So what we did with the ESB guidance was we came up with a unified way of doing it. And the way we did this was the idea was, well, we're in a message-based environment. Why don't we just do message-based exception handling? Wouldn't that make some sense? So that's what got implemented. So with the ESB guidance, when you run into an exception, you create an exception message. If you're in an orchestration, and this is really cool, you can grab messages that are in flight. So you may be partway through doing something in an orchestration. You can grab any messages that you have in flight, make them a payload of your exception message, and then you publish that message back to the bus or the message box, whatever you want to call it, right? And you're done. You, as a developer, you've fulfilled your duties. Something went wrong. You've captured what you could, and you reported it up. Then you use something else to report back on that. So the ESB guidance does have a management portal that ships with it. That's a general purpose thing, not intended for business users. It's kind of like the BAM portal, right? It's more IT pro focused. And the idea is you can go in there and you can see everything that's gone wrong. But because we're using messaging based and you're creating exception messages, well, why don't we go back to that process portal that I mentioned, and why don't we have another send port that's listening in for exception messages of a specific type, or of a specific severity, or from originating from a specific service, and publish those up to that same process portal. Wouldn't that be nice? So you can do that. And with ESB guidance, there's also I don't mean to turn this into an ESB guidance sales pitch, but you can do all this yourselves from scratch, or you can download it, your choice. You can also use a web service. There's, as are some of the other parts of the ESB guidance, the exception management pieces also has a web service associated with it. So that JMS guy could call a web service and say, hey, I've had an exception. This is where it happened. Here's some further details about it. And they would publish that. The exception web service would receive it, publish it into the message box, and then the normal exception management strategy, whatever you defined, would kick in and follow that through. No, because it's a special, so it's an XML document. It's I'm not sure what it was originally based on, but it's based, because it's got BizTalk type context-y things. So all the context properties of messages are captured as well, right? So that can help you in your troubleshooting. It also gives you the ability, because you've got those messages that were in flight, that gives you some interesting repair capabilities, right? Because you can reconstitute those things. You could have a separate orchestration when you do whatever the repair process is, a separate orchestration that you submit it to, or if you've architected it that way, whatever the original thing that failed could have another way in or something, right? You can do that, correlate it back to the running thing. There's options here. The key part to all of this, though, is the fact that there is a unified exception management system here that you can leverage.
And BizTalk also provides out of the box in its actual runtime some good exception handling. So, for example, if a message can't be delivered, it can very often go in the suspended resumable state. Even if you forget to deploy a DLL, your message may be suspended resumable, and you can just fix a problem and batch resume 2,000 messages, and they will actually get processed. So, it's there is a lot of exception handling sort of built into the core engine as it is.
And batch resume as opposed to one at a time. Plus, you got failed message routing too, so you can subscribe to failed messages as well. So again, this is one of those things that it might take you a little bit of time to set up. The management portal out of the box, the ESB guidance management portal, will capture this stuff. I wouldn't give that to a business user, no way, right? I would go the SharePoint route, and I would make it part of a bigger solution for them. So ESB guidance for those, sidebar. So ESB guidance for those of you that don't know, there's a version 2.0 that's available up on CodePlex right now that you can go and get. It's from the Patterns and Practices group at Microsoft. They've been working very, 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 very hard on it. Dramatic changes between the prior version 1.0 and version 2.0. And there are further dramatic changes that I can't talk about that are post that version 2.0, but will be in the release, which should come soon. And when I say soon, usually I mean within 3 months type thing, not 5 years or something like that. But it gives you a whole set of tools that you can work with that just make working in a decoupled or an enterprise service bus environment a lot better and easier. BizTalk Server 2009 will ship with UDDI 3. And the ESB Guidance 2.0 has support for UDDI 3. So that kind of enables some interesting stuff that you can do there. How many people installed ESB Guidance 2.0? How many people enjoyed installing it?
2.0 was fine.
Or sorry, 1.0. Yeah, right. How many actually succeeded? I mean, that was the sort of thing where it was either 2 hours or 5 days with no guarantee of success at the end. So they've done a lot of work around that. They heard you folks loud and clear. They heard from the community about how difficult the installation process was. And part of that is just necessity, right? Because it's touching so many different things. However, a lot of effort was invested in it. From a deployment process standpoint, just getting it installed and getting it set up. So you can get up and running really quickly now, which is great.
Yeah, I didn't believe that it was, I read on somebody's blog it was a 5-minute install, and I thought, yeah, right. And it did actually go in smoothly first time.
Yeah.
So it was great.
Yeah, Dimitri told me 5 minutes, and I just kind of, yeah, sure. 5 minutes, huh? Yeah, I'd like to see that.
It's kind of like that deployment story earlier. You know, is that it?
Yeah, yeah. But this is different. I mean, I didn't believe him. I knew better.
Yeah. So I think we're looking at the break time. Uh-huh. Did you have many more slides to go through? Or?
And stop any time. So, well, to close on that, I mean, have some kind of exception management. This is another one of those things, right, where it's an investment up front. Yeah, it is. But especially if you're spanning multiple technologies, just the troubleshooting time that this can potentially save is huge. right? So it's worth, this is another one of those things, I think, where it's not development tasks, but it's something that you should be putting time into because it'll just make the whole thing better.